Rather than ponder it, she walked through the living room into the bedroom, and there she found the dreadful answer. Three people lay on mattresses around the room, a woman of her own age, a slightly older man, and an adolescent boy. The man was farthest gone in sickness. He lay moaning and sweating in a fever. The open neck of his shirt showed that he had a rash of purple-black spots on his chest and throat. There was blood on his lips and nostrils. He had the plague. "It's come back," said Caris. "God, help me." For a moment, fear paralyzed her. She stood motionless, staring at the scene, feeling powerless. She had always known, in theory, that the plague might return. That was half the reason she had written her book. But even so, she was not prepared for the shock of once again seeing that rash, that fever, that nosebleed. The woman lifted herself on one elbow. She was not so far gone. She had the rash and the fever, but did not appear to be bleeding.
"Give me something to drink, for the love of God," she said.
Giles picked up a jug of wine, and at last Caris's mind started to work, and her body unfroze.
"Don't give her wine. It will make her thirstier," she said. "I saw a barrel of ale in the other room. Draw her a cup of that."
The woman focused on Caris.
"You're the prioress, aren't you?" she said.
Caris did not correct her. "People say you're a saint. Can you make my family well?"
"I'll try. But I'm not a saint. Just a woman who has observed people in sickness and health."
Caris took from her bag a strip of linen and tied it over her mouth and nose. She had not seen a case of the plague for 10 years, but she had got into the habit of taking this precaution whenever she dealt with patients whose illness might be catching. She moistened a clean rag with rose water and bathed the woman's face. As always, the action soothed the patient. Giles came back with a cup of ale, and the woman drank. Caris said to him, "Let them have as much to drink as they want, but give them ale or watered wine." She moved to the father, who did not have long to live. He was not speaking coherently, and his eyes failed to focus on Caris. She bathed his face, cleaning the dried blood from around his nose and mouth. Finally, she attended to Giles's elder brother. He had only recently succumbed, and was still sneezing, but he was old enough to realize how seriously ill he was, and he looked terrified. When she had finished, she said to Giles, "Try to keep them comfortable and give them drinks. There's nothing else you can do. Do you have any relations, uncles or cousins?"
"They're all in Wales."
She made a mental note to warn Bishop Henri that he might need to make arrangements for an orphan boy.
"Mother said to pay you," the boy said. "I haven't done much for you," Caris said. "You can pay me 6 pence."
There was a leather purse beside his mother's bed. He took out 6 silver pennies. The woman raised herself again. Speaking more calmly now, she said,
"What's wrong with us?"
"I'm sorry," said Caris. "It's the plague." The woman nodded fatalistically.
"That's what I was afraid of."
"Don't you recognize the symptoms from last time? We were living in a small town in Wales. We escaped it. Are we all going to die?" Caris did not believe in deceiving people about such important questions.
"A few people survive it," she said. "Not many, though."
"May God have mercy on us, then," said the woman. Caris said, "Amen." All the way back to Kingsbridge, Caris brooded on the plague. It would spread, of course, just as fast as last time. It would kill thousands. The prospect filled her with rage. It was like the senseless carnage of war, except that war was caused by men and the plague was not. What was she going to do? She could not sit back and watch as the events of 13 years ago were cruelly repeated. There was no cure for the plague, but she had discovered ways to slow its murderous progress. As her horse jogged the well-worn road through the forest, she thought over what she knew about the illness and how to combat it. Merthyn was quiet, recognizing her mood, probably guessing accurately what she was thinking about. When they got home, She explained to him what she wanted to do. "There will be opposition," he warned. "Your plan is drastic. Those who did not lose family and friends last time may imagine they are invulnerable and say you're overreacting." "That's where you can help me," she said. "In that case, I recommend we divide up the potential objectors and deal with them separately." "All right." "You have three groups to win over. The Guild, the monks, and the nuns. Let's start with the Guild. I'll call a meeting, and I won't invite Philemon." Nowadays the Guild met in the Cloth Exchange, a large new stone building on the main street. It enabled traders to do business even in bad weather. It had been paid for by profits from Kingsbridge Scarlet. But before the Guild convened, Carys and Merthyn met individually with the leading members to win their support in advance, a technique Merthyn had developed long ago. His motto was, "Never call a meeting until the result is a foregone conclusion." Carys herself went to see Madge Webber. Madge had married again. Much to everyone's amusement, she had enchanted a villager as handsome as her first husband and 15 years her junior. His name was Anselm, and he seemed to adore her, though she was as plump as ever and covered her grey hair with a selection of exotic caps. Even more surprising, in her 40s she had conceived again and given birth to a healthy baby girl, Selma, now 8 years old and attending the nuns' school. Motherhood had never kept Madge from doing business, and she continued to dominate the market in Kingsbridge Scarlet, with Anselm as her lieutenant. Her home was still the large house on the main street that she and Mark had moved into when she first began to profit from weaving and dyeing. Carys found her and Anselm taking delivery of a consignment of red cloth, trying to find room for it in the overcrowded storeroom on the ground floor. "I'm stocking up for the fleece fair," Madge explained. Carys waited while she checked the delivery. Then they went upstairs, leaving Anselm in charge of the shop. As Carys entered the living room, she was vividly reminded of the day, 13 years ago, when she had been summoned here to see Mark, the first Kingsbridge victim of the plague. She suddenly felt depressed. Madge noticed her expression. "What is it?" she said. "You could not hide things from women the way you could from men. I walked in here 13 years ago, because Mark was ill," Carys said. Madge nodded. "That was the beginning of the worst time of my life," she said in her matter-of-fact voice. "That day, I had a wonderful husband and 4 healthy children. 3 months later, I was a childless widow with nothing to live for." "Days of grief," Carys said. Madge went to the sideboard, where there were cups and a jug, but instead of offering Carys a drink, she stood staring at the wall. "Shall I tell you something strange?" she said. "After they died, I couldn't say amen to the paternoster." She swallowed, and her voice went quieter. "I know what the Latin means, you see. My father taught me. Fiat voluntas tua. Thy will be done. I couldn't say that. God had taken my family, and that was sufficient torture. I would not acquiesce in it." Tears came to her eyes as she remembered. "I didn't want God's will to prevail. I wanted my children back. Thy will be done. I knew I'd go to hell, but still I couldn't say amen." Carys said, "The plague has come back." Madge staggered and clutched the sideboard for support. Her solid figure suddenly looked frail, and as the confidence went from her face, she appeared old. "No," she said. Carys pulled the bench forward and held Madge's arm while she sat on it. "I'm sorry to shock you," she said. "No," Madge said again. "It can't come back. I can't lose Anselm and Selma. I can't bear it. I can't bear it." She looked so white and drawn that Carys began to fear she might suffer some kind of attack. Carys poured wine from the jug into a cup. She gave it to Madge, who drank it automatically. A little of her color came back. "We understand it better now," Carys said. "Perhaps we can fight it." "Fight it? How can we do that?" "That's what I've come to tell you. Are you feeling a little better?" Madge met Caris's eye at last. "Fight it," she said. "Of course, that's what we must do. Tell me how. We have to close the city, shut the gates, man the walls, prevent anyone coming in. But the city has to eat. People will bring supplies to Leper Island. Merthyn will act as middleman and pay them. He contracted the plague last time and survived. And no one has ever got it twice. Traders will leave their goods on the bridge. Then, when they have gone, people will come out from the city and get the food."
"Could people leave the city?"
"Yes, but they couldn't come back."
"What about the fleece fair?"
"That may be the hardest part," Caris said. "It must be cancelled."
"But Kingsbridge merchants will lose hundreds of pounds.
It's better than dying."
"If we do as you say, will we avoid the plague?
Will my family survive?" Caris hesitated, resisting the temptation to tell a reassuring lie.
"I can't promise," she said.
"The plague may already have reached us. There may be someone right now dying alone in a hovel near the waterfront with nobody to get help. So I fear we may not escape entirely. But I believe my plan gives you the best chance of still having Anselm and Selma by your side at Christmas."
"Then we'll do it," Madge said decisively.
"Your support is crucial," Caris said.
"Frankly, you will lose more money than anyone else from the cancellation of the fair. For that reason, people are more likely to believe you. I need you to say how serious it is."
"Don't worry," said Madge. "I'll tell them."
"A very sound idea," said Prior Philemon. Merthyn was surprised. He could not remember a time when Philemon had agreed readily with a proposal of the guild's.
"Then you will support it," he said, to make sure he had heard aright.
"Yes, indeed," said the prior.
He was eating a bowl of raisins, stuffing handfuls into his mouth as fast as he could chew them. He did not offer Merthyn any.
"Of course," he said, "it wouldn't apply to monks."
Merthyn sighed. He might have known better.
"On the contrary, it applies to everyone," he said.
"No, no," said Philemon, in the tone of one who instructs a child. "The guild has no power to restrict the movements of monks." Merthyn noticed a cat at Philemon's feet. It was fat, like him, with a mean face. It looked just like Godwin's cat, Archbishop, though that creature must be long dead. Perhaps it was a descendant. Merthyn said, "The guild has the power to close the city gates. But we have the right to come and go as we please. We're not subject to the authority of the guild. That would be ridiculous."
"All the same, the guild controls the city, and we have decided that no one can enter while the plague is rife."
"You cannot make rules for the priory."
"But I can for the city, and the priory happens to be in the city.
Are you telling me that if I leave Kingsbridge today, you will refuse me admission tomorrow?"
Merthyn was not sure. It would be highly embarrassing, at a minimum, to have the prior of Kingsbridge standing outside the gate demanding admission. He had been hoping to persuade Philemon to accept the restriction. He did not want to put the resolve of the guild to the test quite so dramatically. However, he tried to make his answer sound confident.
"Absolutely. I shall complain to the bishop.
Tell him he can't enter Kingsbridge." The personnel of the nunnery had hardly changed in 10 years, Caris realized. Nunneries were like that, of course. You were supposed to stay forever. Mother Joan was still prioress, and Sister Una ran the hospital under the supervision of Brother Syme. Few people came here for medical care now. Most preferred Caris's hospital on the island. Those patients Syme did have, devoutly religious for the most part, were cared for in the old hospital next to the kitchens, while the new building was used for guests. Caris sat down with Joan, Una, and Syme in the old pharmacy, now used as the prioress's private office, and explained her plan. "People outside the walls of the old city who fall victim to the plague will be admitted to my hospital on the island," she said. "While the plague lasts, the nuns and I will stay within the building night and day. Nobody will leave except those lucky few who recover."
Joan asked, "What about here in the old city?"
"If the plague gets into the city despite our precautions,
there may be too many victims for the accommodation you have. The Guild has ruled that plague victims and their families will be confined to their homes. The rule applies to anyone who lives in a house struck by plague. Parents, children, grandparents, servants, apprentices. Anyone caught leaving such a house will be hanged.
It's very harsh, Joan said, but if it prevents the awful slaughter of the last plague, it's worthwhile.
I knew you'd see that. Syme was saying nothing. The news of the plague seemed to have deflated his arrogance. Una said, How will the victims eat if they're imprisoned in their homes?
Neighbors can leave food on the doorstep. No one may go in, except monk physicians and nuns. They will visit the sick, but they must have no contact with the healthy. They will go from the priory to the home, and from the home back to the priory, without entering any other building, or even speaking to anyone on the street. They should wear masks at all times, and wash their hands in vinegar each time they touch a patient.
Syme was looking terrified.
Will that protect us? He said.
To some degree, Carys said. Not completely.
But then it will be highly dangerous for us to attend the sick.
Una answered him. We have no fear, she said. We look forward to death. For us, it is the longed-for reunion with Christ.
Yes, of course, said Syme.
The next day, all the monks left Kingsbridge. Chapter 88 Gwenda felt murderously angry when she saw what Ralph had done to Davy's madder plants. Wanton destruction of crops was a sin. There should be a special place in hell for noblemen who despoiled what peasants had sweated to grow.
But Davy was not dismayed.
I don't think it matters, he said. The value is in the roots, and he hasn't touched them.
That would have been too much like work, Gwenda said sourly, but she cheered up.
In fact, the shrubs recovered remarkably quickly. Ralph probably did not know that madder propagated underground. Throughout May and June, as reports began to reach Wigley of an outbreak of the plague, the roots sent up new shoots, and at the beginning of July, Davy decided it was time to harvest the crop. One Sunday, Gwenda, Wulfric, and Davy spent the afternoon digging up the roots. They would first loosen the soil around the plant, then pull it out of the ground, then strip its foliage, leaving the root attached to a short stem. It was back-aching work of the kind Gwenda had done all her life. They left half the plantation untouched, in the hope that it would regenerate itself next year. They pulled a handcart, piled with madder roots, back through the woods to Wigley, then unloaded the roots into the barn and spread them in the hayloft to dry. Davy did not know when he would be able to sell his crop. Kingsbridge was a closed city. The people still bought supplies, of course, but only through brokers. Davy was doing something new, and he would need to explain the situation to his buyer. It would be awkward to do that through an intermediary, but perhaps he would have to try. He had to dry the roots first, then grind them to a powder, and that would take time anyway. Davy had said no more about Amabel, but Gwenda felt sure he was still seeing the girl. He pretended to be cheerfully resigned to his fate. If he had really given her up, he would have moped resentfully. All Gwenda could do was hope he would get over her before he was old enough to marry without permission. She still could hardly bear even to think of her family being joined to Annett's. Annett had never ceased to humiliate her by flirting with Wulfric, who continued to grin foolishly at every stupid, coquettish remark. Now that Annett was in her 40s, with broken veins in her rosy cheeks and grey streaks among her fair ringlets, her behaviour was not just embarrassing but grotesque. Yet Wulfric reacted as if she were still a girl. And now, Gwenda thought, my son has fallen into the same trap. It made her want to spit. Amabel looked just like Annett 25 years ago. A pretty face with flyaway curls, a long neck and narrow white shoulders, and small breasts like the eggs that mother and daughter sold at markets. She had the same way of tossing her hair, the same trick of looking at a man with mock reproach, and hitting his chest with the back of her hand, in a gesture that pretended to be a smack, but was in fact a caress. However, Davy was at least physically safe and well. Gwenda was more worried about Sam, living now with Earl Ralph at the castle, learning to be a fighting man. In church, she prayed he would not be injured hunting, or learning to use a sword, or fighting in a tournament. She had seen him every day for 22 years, then suddenly he had been taken from her. It's hard to be a woman, she thought. You love your baby with all your heart and soul, and then one day he just leaves. For several weeks she looked for an excuse to travel to Earl's castle and check on Sam. Then she heard that the plague had struck there, and that decided her. She would go before the harvest got under way. Wulfric would not go with her. He had too much to do on the land. Anyway, she had no fear of travelling alone. Too poor to be robbed, too old to be raped, she joked. The truth was that she was too tough for either, and she carried a long knife. She walked across the drawbridge at Earl's castle on a hot July day. On the battlements of the gatehouse, a raven stood like a sentry, the sun glinting off his glossy black feathers. He cawed a warning at her. It sounded like, "Go! Go!" She had escaped the plague once, of course, but that might have been luck. She was risking her life by coming here. The scene in the lower compound was normal, if a little quiet. A woodcutter was unloading a cart full of firewood outside the bakehouse, and a groom was unsaddling a dusty horse in front of the stables. But there was no great bustle of activity. She noticed a small group of men and women outside the west entrance of the little church, and crossed the baked earth ground to investigate. "Plague victims inside?" a maidservant said in answer to her inquiry. She stepped through the door, feeling dread like a cold lump in her heart. 10 or 12 straw mattresses were lined up on the floor, so that the occupants could face the altar, just as in a hospital. About half the patients seemed to be children. There were 3 grown men. Gwenda scanned their faces fearfully. None of them was Sam. She knelt down and said a prayer of thanks. Outside, she approached the woman she had spoken to earlier. "I'm looking for Sam from Wigley," she said. "He's a new squire." The woman pointed to the bridge leading to the inner compound. "Try the cape." Gwenda took the route indicated. A sentry at the bridge ignored her. She climbed the steps to the keep. The great hall was dark and cool. A big dog slept on the cold stones of the fireplace. There were benches around the walls, and a pair of large armchairs at the far end of the room. Gwenda noticed that there were no cushions, no upholstered seats, and no wall hangings. She deduced that Lady Philippa spent little time here, and took no interest in the furnishings. Sam was sitting near a window with 3 younger men. The parts of a suit of armour were laid out on the floor in front of them, arranged in order from faceplate to greaves. Each of the men was cleaning a piece. Sam was rubbing the breastplate with a smooth pebble, trying to remove rust. She stood watching him for a moment. He wore new clothes in the red and black livery of the Earl of Shiring. The colours suited his dark, good looks. He seemed to be at ease, talking in a desultory way with the others while they all worked. He appeared healthy and well-fed. It was what Gwenda had hoped for, but all the same she suffered a perverse pang of disappointment that he was doing so well without her. He glanced up and saw her. His face registered surprise, then pleasure, then amusement. "Lads," he said, "I am the oldest among you, and you may think I'm capable of looking after myself, but it's not so. My mother follows me everywhere to make sure I'm all right." They saw her and laughed. Sam put down his work and came over. Mother and son sat on a bench in a corner near the staircase that led to the upstairs rooms. "I'm having a wonderful time," Sam said. "Everyone plays games here most days. We go hunting and hawking. We have wrestling matches and contests of horsemanship. And we play football. I've learned so much. It's a bit embarrassing to be grouped with these adolescents all the time, but I can put up with that. I just have to master the skill of using a sword and shield while riding a horse at the same time." He was already speaking differently, she noticed. He was losing the slow rhythms of village speech, and he used French words for hawking and horsemanship.
He was becoming assimilated into the life of the nobility.
"What about the work?" she said.
"It can't be all play."
"Yes, there's plenty of work."
He gestured at the others cleaning the armor. "But it's easy by comparison with ploughing and harrowing." He asked about his brother, and she told him all the news from home. Davy's madder had regenerated. They had dug up the roots. Davy was still involved with Amabel. No one had fallen sick of the plague yet. While they were talking, she began to feel that she was being watched, and she knew her feeling was not fanciful. After a moment, she looked over her shoulder. Earl Ralph was standing at the top of the staircase in front of an open door, evidently having stepped out of his room. She wondered how long he had been looking at her. She met his gaze. His stare was intense, but she could not read it, did not understand what it meant. She began to feel the look was uncomfortably intimate, and she glanced away. When she looked back, he had gone. The next day, when she was on the road and halfway home, a horseman came up behind her, riding fast, then slowed down and stopped. Her hand went to the long dagger in her belt. The rider was Sir Alan Fernhill. "The Earl wants to see you," he said.
"Then he had better come himself instead of sending you," she replied. "You've always got a smart answer, haven't you? Do you imagine it endears you to your superiors?"
He had a point. She was taken aback, perhaps because in all the years he had been Ralph's sidekick, she had never known Alan to say anything intelligent. If she was really smart, she would suck up to people such as Alan, not poke fun at them. "All right," she said wearily. "The Earl bids me to him. Must I walk all the way back to the castle?"
"No.
He has a lodge in the forest not far from here, where he sometimes stops for refreshment during a hunt. He's there now." He pointed into the woods beside the road. Gwenda did not much like this, but, as a serf, she had no right to decline a summons from her Earl. Anyway, if she did refuse, she felt sure Alan would knock her down and tie her up and carry her there.
"Very well," she said.
"Jump up on the saddle in front of me, if you like."
"No, thanks. I'd rather walk."
At this time of year, the undergrowth was thick. Gwenda followed the horse into the woods, taking advantage of the path it trampled through the nettles and ferns. The road behind them swiftly disappeared into the greenery. Gwenda wondered nervously what whim had caused Ralph to arrange this forest meeting. It could not be good news for her or her family, she felt. They walked a quarter of a mile and came to a low building with a thatched roof. Gwenda would have assumed it to be a verderer's cottage. Alan looped his reins around a sapling and led the way inside. The place had about it the same bare utilitarian look Gwenda had noted at Earl's castle. The floor was beaten earth, the walls unfinished wattle and daub, the ceiling nothing more than the underside of the thatch. The furniture was minimal. A table, some benches, and a plain wooden bedstead with a straw mattress. A door at the back stood half open on a small kitchen where, presumably, Ralph's servants prepared food and drink for him and his fellow huntsmen. Ralph was sitting at the table with a cup of wine. Gwenda stood in front of him, waiting. Alan leaned against the wall behind her.
"So, Alan found you," Ralph said.
"Is there no one else here?" Gwenda said nervously.
"Just you, me, and Alan."
Gwenda's anxiety went up a notch.
"Why do you want to see me?"
"To talk about Sam, of course."
"You've taken him from me?
What else is there to say?"
"He's a good boy, you know, our son."
"Don't call him that." She looked at Alan. He showed no surprise. Clearly he had been let in on the secret. She was dismayed. Wulfric must never find out.
"Don't call him our son," she said.
"You've never been a father to him. Wulfric raised him."
"How could I raise him? I didn't even know he was mine. But I'm making up for lost time."
"He's doing well, did he tell you?"
"Does he get into fights?"
"Of course. Squires are supposed to fight. It's practice for when they go to war. You should have asked whether he wins."
"It's not the life I wanted for him."
"It's the life he was made for." Did you bring me here to gloat? Why don't you sit down?
Reluctantly, she sat opposite him at the table. He poured wine into a cup and pushed it towards her. She ignored it. He said, Now that I know we have a son together, I think we should be more intimate.
No, thank you. You're such a killjoy. Don't you talk to me about joy. You've been a blight on my life. With all my heart, I wish I had never set eyes on you. I don't want to be intimate with you. I want to get away from you. If you went to Jerusalem, it wouldn't be far enough.
His face darkened with anger, and she regretted the extravagance of her words. She recalled Alan's rebuke. She wished she could say no simply and calmly, without stinging witticisms, but Ralph aroused her ire like no one else.
"Can't you see?" she said, trying to be reasonable. "You have hated my husband for, what, a quarter of a century? He broke your nose, and you slashed his cheek open. You disinherited him, then you were forced to give him back his family's lands. You raped the woman he once loved. He ran away, and you dragged him back with a rope around his neck. After all that, even having a son together cannot make you and me friends."
"I disagree," he said. "I think we can be not just friends, but lovers."
"No!"
It was what she had feared, in the back of her mind, ever since Alan had reined in on the road in front of her. Ralph smiled. "Why don't you take off your dress?" She tensed. Alan leaned over her from behind and slipped the long dagger out of her belt with a smooth motion. He had obviously premeditated the move, and it happened too quickly for her to react. But Ralph said, "No, Alan, that won't be necessary. She'll do it willingly."
"I will not," she said.
"Give her back the dagger, Alan." Reluctantly, Alan reversed the knife, holding it by the blade, and offered it to her. She snatched it and leaped to her feet.
"You may kill me, but I'll take one of you with me, by God," she said.
She backed away, holding the knife at arm's length, ready to fight. Alan stepped towards the door, moving to cut her off.
"Leave her be," Ralph said. "She's not going anywhere."
She had no idea why Ralph was so confident, but he was dead wrong. She was getting out of this hut, and then she was going to run away as fast as she could, and she would not stop until she dropped. Alan stayed where he was. Gwenda got to the door, reached behind her, and lifted the simple wooden latch. Ralph said,
"Wulfric doesn't know, does he?"
Gwenda froze.
"Doesn't know what?"
"He doesn't know that I'm Sam's father." Gwenda's voice fell to a whisper.
"No, he doesn't.
I wonder how he would feel if he found out."
"It would kill him," she said.
"That's what I thought."
"Please don't tell him," she begged.
"I won't, so long as you do as I say." What could she do? She knew Ralph was drawn to her sexually. She had used that knowledge, in desperation, to get in to see him at the sheriff's castle. Their encounter at the Bell all those years ago, a vile memory to her, had lived in his recollection as a golden moment, probably much enhanced by the passage of time, and she had put into his head the idea of reliving that moment. This was her own fault. Could she somehow disabuse him?
"We aren't the same people we were all those years ago," she said.
"I will never be an innocent young girl again. You should go back to your serving, wenches." "I don't want serving girls. I want you."
"No,"
she said.
"Please."
She fought back tears. He was implacable. "Take off your dress." She sheathed her knife and unbuckled her belt. Chapter 89. The moment Merthyn woke up, he thought of Lola. She had been missing now for 3 months. He had sent messages to the city authorities in Gloucester, Monmouth, Shaftesbury, Exeter, Winchester, and Salisbury. Letters from him, as alderman of one of the great cities of the land, were treated seriously, and he had received careful replies to them all. Only the Mayor of London had been unhelpful, saying in effect that half the girls in the city had run away from their fathers, and it was no business of the mayor's to send them home. Merthyn had made personal inquiries in Shiring, Bristol, and Melcombe. He had spoken to the landlord of every tavern, giving them a description of Lola. They had all seen plenty of dark-haired young women, often in the company of handsome rogues called Jake, or Jack, or Jock. But none could say for sure that they had seen Merthyn's daughter, or heard the name Lola. Some of Jake's friends had also vanished, along with a girlfriend or two, the other missing women all some years older than Lola. Lola might be dead, Merthyn knew that, but he refused to give up hope. It was unlikely she had caught the plague. The new outbreak was ravaging towns and villages, and taking away most of the children under 10. But survivors of the first wave, such as Lola and himself, must have been people who, for some reason, had the strength to resist the illness, or, in a very few cases, such as his own, to recover from it. And they were not falling sick this time. However, the plague was only one of the hazards to a 16-year-old girl running away from home, and Merthyn's fertile imagination tortured him, in the small hours of the night, with thoughts of what might have happened to her. One town not ravaged by the plague was Kingsbridge. The illness had affected about one house in 100 in the old town, as far as Merthyn could tell from the conversations he held, shouted across the city gate with Madge Webber, who was acting as alderman inside the city walls, while Merthyn managed affairs outside. The Kingsbridge suburbs and other towns were seeing something like 1 in 5 afflicted. But had Carus's methods overcome the plague, or merely delayed it? Would the illness persist, and eventually overcome the barriers she had put up? Would the devastation be as bad as last time in the end? They would not know until the outbreak had run its course, which might be months or years. He sighed and got up out of his lonely bed. He had not seen Carus since the city was closed. She was living at the hospital, a few yards from Merthyn's house, but she could not leave the building. People could go in, but not come out. Carus had decided she would have no credibility unless she worked side by side with her nuns, so she was stuck. Merthyn had spent half his life separated from her, it seemed. But it did not get any easier. In fact, he ached for her more now in middle age than he had as a youngster. His housekeeper, Em, was up before him, and he found her in the kitchen skinning rabbits. He ate a piece of bread and drank some weak beer, then went outside. The main road across the island was already crowded with peasants and their carts bringing supplies. Merthyn and a team of helpers spoke to each of them. Those bringing standard products with agreed prices were the simplest. Merthyn sent them across the inner bridge to deposit their goods at the locked door of the gatehouse, then paid them when they came back empty. With those bringing seasonal produce, such as fruits and vegetables, he negotiated a price before allowing them to deliver. For some special consignments, a deal had been made days earlier, when he placed the order. Hides for the leather trade, stones for the masons, who had recommenced building the spire under Bishop Henri's orders, silver for the jewellers, iron, steel, hemp, and timber for the city's manufacturers, who had to continue working, even though they were temporarily cut off from most of their customers. Finally, there were the one-off cargoes, for which Merthyn would need to take instructions from someone in the city. Today brought a vendor of Italian brocade, who wanted to sell it to one of the city's tailors, a year-old ox for the slaughterhouse, and Davy from Wigley. Merthyn listened to Davy's story with amazement and pleasure. He admired the lad for his enterprise in buying madder seeds and cultivating them to produce the costly dye. He was not surprised to learn that Ralph had tried to scuttle the project. Ralph was like most noblemen in his contempt for anything connected with manufacture or trade. But Davy had nerve as well as brains, and he had persisted. He had even paid a miller to grind the dried roots into powder. When the miller washed the grindstone afterwards, his dog drank some of the water that ran off, Davy told Merthyn. The dog pissed red for a week, so we know the dye works. Now he was here with a handcart loaded with old 4-gallon flour sacks, full of what he believed to be precious madder dye. Merthin told him to pick up one of the sacks and bring it to the gate. When they got there, he called out to the sentry on the other side. The man climbed to the battlements and looked down. "This sack is for Madge Webber," Merthin shouted up. "Make sure she gets it personally, would you, sentry?"
"Very good, Alderman," said the sentry.
As always, a few plague victims from the villages were brought to the island by their relatives. Most people now knew there was no cure for the plague and simply let their loved ones die. But a few were ignorant or optimistic enough to hope that Karis could work a miracle. The sick were left outside the hospital doors, like supplies at the city gate. The nuns came out for them at night when the relatives had gone. Now and again, a lucky survivor emerged in good health. But most patients went out through the back door and were buried in a new graveyard on the far side of the hospital building. At midday, Merthin invited Davy to dinner. Over rabbit pie and new peas, Davy confessed he was in love with the daughter of his mother's old enemy. "I don't know why Ma hates Annette, but it's all so long in the past. It's nothing to do with me or Amabel," he said, with the indignation of youth against the irrationality of parents. When Merthin nodded sympathetically, Davy asked, "Did your parents stand in your way like this?" Merthin thought for a moment. "Yes," he said. "I wanted to be a squire and spend my life as a knight fighting for the king. I was heartbroken when they apprenticed me to a carpenter. However, in my case, it worked out quite well." Davy was not pleased by this anecdote. In the afternoon, access to the inner bridge was closed off at the island end, and the gates of the city were opened. Teams of porters came out and picked up everything that had been left, and carried the supplies to their destinations in the city. There was no message from Madge about the dye. Merthin had a second visitor that day. Towards the end of the afternoon, as trading petered out, Canon Claude arrived. Claude's friend and patron, Bishop Henri, was now installed as Archbishop of Monmouth. However, his replacement as Bishop of Kingsbridge had not been chosen. Claude wanted the position, and had been to London to see Sir Gregory Longfellow. He was on his way back to Monmouth, where he would continue to work as Henri's right-hand man for the moment. "The king likes Philemon's line on taxation of the clergy," he said over cold rabbit pie, and a goblet of Merthin's best Gascon wine, "and the senior clergy liked the sermon against dissection and the plan to build a lady chapel. On the other hand, Gregory dislikes Philemon, says he can't be trusted. The upshot is, the king has postponed the decision by ruling that the monks of Kingsbridge cannot hold an election while they are in exile at St. John in the Forest." Merthin said, "I assume the king sees little point in selecting a bishop while the plague rages and the city is closed." Claude nodded agreement. "I did achieve something, albeit small," he went on. "There is a vacancy for an English ambassador to the Pope. The appointee has to live in Avignon. I suggested Philemon. Gregory seemed intrigued by the idea. At least, he didn't rule it out." "Good." The thought of Philemon being sent so far away lifted Merthin's spirits. He wished there was something he could do to weigh in on Claude's side, but he had already written to Gregory pledging the support of the guild, and that was the limit of his influence. "One more piece of news. Sad news, in fact," Claude said. "On my way to London, I went to St. John in the Forest. Henri is still abbot, technically, and he sent me to reprimand Philemon for decamping without permission. Waste of time, really. Anyway, Philemon has adopted Caris's precautions and would not let me in, but we talked through the door. So far, the monks have escaped the plague, but your old friend, Brother Thomas, has died of old age. I'm sorry." "God rest his soul," Merthin said sadly. He was very frail towards the end. His mind was going too. "The move to St. John probably didn't help him. Thomas encouraged me when I was a young builder. Strange how God sometimes takes the good men from us and leaves the bed. Claude left early the next morning. As Merthyn was going through his daily routine, one of the carters came back from the city gate with a message. Madge Webber was on the battlements and wanted to talk to Merthyn and Davy.
"Do you think she'll buy my manor?"
Davy said as they walked across the inner bridge. Merthyn had no idea.
"I hope so," he said.
They stood side by side in front of the closed gate and looked up. Madge leaned over the wall and shouted down,
"Where did this stuff come from?"
"I grew it,"
Davy said.
"And who are you?"
"Davy from Waigley, son of Wulfric."
"Oh, Gwenda's boy?"
"Yes, the younger one."
"Well, I've tested your dye. It works, doesn't it?"
Davy said eagerly.
"It's very weak. Did you grind the roots whole?"
"Yes.
What else would I have done?"
"You're supposed to remove the hulls before grinding."
"I didn't know that."
Davy was crestfallen.
"Is the powder no good?"
"As I said, it's weak. I can't pay the price of pure dye."
Davy looked so disheartened that Merthyn's heart went out to him.
Madge said, "How much have you got?"
9 more 4-gallon sacks like the one you have,"
Davy said despondently.
"I'll give you half the usual price, 3 shillings and 6 pence a gallon. That's 14 shillings a sack, so exactly £7 for 10 sacks.
Davy's face was a picture of delight. Merthyn wished Carys were with him just to share it.
£7?
Davy repeated. Thinking he was disappointed, Madge said,
"I can't do better than that. The dye just isn't strong enough."
But £7 was a fortune to Davy. It was several years' wages for a labourer, even at today's rates. He looked at Merthyn.
"I'm rich," he said.
Merthyn laughed and said, "Don't spend it all at once." The next day was Sunday. Merthyn went to the morning service at the island's own little church of St. Elizabeth of Hungary, patron saint of healers. Then he went home and got a stout oak spade from his gardener's hut. With the spade over his shoulder, he walked across the outer bridge, through the suburbs, and into his past. He tried hard to remember the route he had taken through the forest 34 years ago with Carys, Ralph, and Gwenda. It seemed impossible. There were no pathways other than deer runs. Saplings had become mature trees, and mighty oaks had been felled by the king's woodcutters. Nevertheless, to his surprise, there were still recognizable landmarks, a spring gurgling up out of the ground where he remembered the 10-year-old Carys kneeling to drink, a huge rock that she said looked as if it must have fallen from heaven, a steep-sided little valley with a boggy bottom where she had got mud in her boots. As he walked, his recollection of that day of childhood became more vivid. He remembered how the dog, Hop, had followed them, and Gwenda had followed her dog. He felt again the pleasure of having Carys understand his joke. His face reddened at the recollection of how incompetent he had been in front of Carys with the bow he had made, and how easily his younger brother had mastered the weapon. He realized now that Ralph's boyish nastiness in killing the dog had been an early sign of the adult brutality he would later show to human beings. Most of all, he remembered Carys as a girl. They had been pre-adolescent, but nevertheless he had been bewitched by her quick wits, her daring, and the effortless way she had assumed command of the little group. It was not love, but it was a kind of fascination that was not unlike love. Remembrance distracted him from pathfinding, and he lost his bearings. He began to feel as if he was in completely unfamiliar territory. Then suddenly he emerged into a clearing and knew he was in the right place. The bushes were more extensive, the trunk of the oak tree was even broader, and the clearing in between was gay with a scatter of summer flowers, as it had not been on that November day in 1327. But he was in no doubt. It was like a face he had not seen for years, changed, but unmistakable. A shorter and skinnier Merthyn had crawled under that bush to hide from the big man crashing through the undergrowth. He remembered how the exhausted, panting Thomas had stood with his back to that oak tree and drawn his sword and dagger. He saw in his imagination the events of that day played out again. Two men in yellow and green livery had caught up with Thomas and asked him for a letter. Thomas had distracted the men by telling them they were being observed by someone hiding in a bush. Merthyn had felt sure he and the other children would be murdered. Then Ralph, just 10 years old, had killed one of the men-at-arms, showing the quick and deadly reflexes that had served him so well years later in the French wars. Thomas had dispatched the other man, though not before receiving the wound that had ended in his losing his left arm, despite, or perhaps because of, the treatment given him in the hospital at Kingsbridge Priory. Then Merthyn had helped Thomas bury the letter. "Just here," Thomas had said, "right in front of the oak tree." There was a secret in the letter, Merthyn knew now, a secret so potent that high-ranking people were frightened of it. The secret had given Thomas protection, though he had nevertheless sought sanctuary in a monastery and spent his life there. "If you hear that I've died," Thomas had said to the boy Merthyn, "I'd like you to dig up this letter and give it to a priest." Merthyn, the man, hefted his spade and began to dig. He was not sure whether this was what Thomas had intended. The buried letter was a precaution against Thomas's being killed by violence, not dying of natural causes at the age of 58. Would he still have wanted the letter dug up? Merthyn did not know. He would decide what to do when he had read the letter. He was irresistibly curious to know what was in it. His memory of where he had buried the bag was not perfect, and with his first try he missed the spot. He got down about 18 inches and realized his mistake. The hole had been only about a foot deep, he was sure. He tried again a few inches to the left. This time he got it right. A foot down, the spade struck something that was not earth. It was soft, but unyielding. He put the spade to one side and scrabbled with his fingers in the hole. He felt a piece of ancient, rotting leather. Gently, he dislodged the earth and lifted the object. It was the wallet Thomas had worn on his belt all those years ago. He wiped his muddy hands on his tunic and opened it. Inside was a bag made of oiled wool, still intact. He loosened the drawstring of the bag and reached in. He pulled out a sheet of parchment, rolled into a scroll and sealed with wax. He handled it gently, but all the same the wax crumbled as soon as he touched it. With careful fingertips he unrolled the parchment. It was intact. It had survived 34 years in the earth remarkably well. He saw immediately that it was not an official document, but a personal letter. He could tell by the handwriting, which was the painstaking scrawl of an educated nobleman rather than the practiced script of a clerk. He began to read. The salutation ran, "From Edward, the second of that name, King of England, at Berkeley Castle, by the hand of his faithful servant, Sir Thomas Langley, to his beloved eldest son, Edward. Royal greeting and fatherly love." Merthyn felt scared. This was a message from the old king to the new. The hand holding the document shook, and he looked up from it and scanned the greenery around him, as if there might be someone peering at him through the bushes. "My beloved son, you will soon hear that I am dead. Know that it is not true." Merthyn frowned. This was not what he had expected. "Your mother, the queen, the wife of my heart, has corrupted and subverted Roland, Earl of Shiring, and his sons, who sent murderers here. But I was forewarned by Thomas, and the murderers were killed." So Thomas had not been the assassin after all, but the savior of the king. "Your mother, having failed to kill me once, would surely try again, for she and her adulterous consort cannot feel safe while I live. So I have changed clothes with one of the slain murderers, a man of my height and general appearance, and I have bribed several people to swear that the dead body is mine. Your mother will know the truth when she sees the body, but she will go along with the pretense. For if I am thought to be dead, I will be no threat to her, and no rebel or rival to the throne can claim my support." Merthyn was amazed. The nation had thought Edward II to be dead. All Europe had been fooled. But what had happened to him afterwards? "I will not tell you where I plan to go, but know that I intend to leave my kingdom of England and never return. However, I pray that I will again see you, my son, before I die." Why had Thomas buried this letter instead of delivering it? Because he had feared for his own life, and had seen the letter as a powerful weapon in his defense. Once Queen Isabella had committed herself to the pretense of her husband's death, she had needed to deal with those few people who knew the truth. Merthyn now recalled that while he was still an adolescent, the Earl of Kent had been convicted of treason and beheaded for maintaining that Edward II was still alive. Queen Isabella had sent men to kill Thomas, and they had caught up with him just outside Kingsbridge. But Thomas had disposed of them with the help of the 10-year-old Ralph. Afterwards, Thomas must have threatened to expose the whole deception, and he had proof in the form of the old king's letter. That evening, as he lay in the hospital at Kingsbridge Priory, Thomas had negotiated with the Queen, or more likely with Earl Roland and his sons as her agents. He had promised to keep the secret on condition that he was accepted as a monk. He would feel safe in the monastery, and in case the Queen should be tempted to renege, he had said that the letter was in a safe place and would be revealed on his death. The Queen, therefore, needed to keep him alive. Old Prior Antony had known something of this, and as he lay dying had told Mother Cecilia, who on her own deathbed had repeated part of the story to Carus. People might keep secrets for decades, Merthyn reflected, but they felt compelled to tell the truth when death was near. Carus had also seen the incriminating document that gave Lynn Grange to the priory, on condition Thomas was accepted as a monk. Merthyn now understood why Carus's disingenuous inquiries about this document had caused such trouble. Sir Gregory Longfellow had persuaded Ralph to break into the monastery and steal all the nuns' charters in the hope of finding the incriminating letter. Had the destructive power of this sheet of vellum been lessened by the passage of time? Isabella had lived a long life, but she had died 3 years ago. Edward II himself was almost certainly dead. If alive, he would be 77 now. Would Edward III fear the revelation that his father had remained alive when the world thought him dead? He was too strong a king now to be seriously threatened, but he would face great embarrassment and humiliation. So what was Merthyn to do? He remained where he was on the grassy floor of the forest among the wildflowers for a long time. At last he rolled up the scroll, replaced it in the bag, and put the bag back in the old leather pouch. He put the pouch back into the ground and filled up the hole. He also filled in his first erroneous hole. He smoothed the earth on top of both. He stripped some leaves off the bushes and scattered them in front of the oak tree. He stood back and looked at his work. He was satisfied. The excavations were no longer visible to the casual glance. Then he turned his back on the clearing and went home. Chapter 90. At the end of August, Earl Ralph made a tour of his landholdings around Shiring, accompanied by his long-term sidekick, Sir Alan Fernhill, and his new-found son, Sam. He enjoyed having Sam along, his child, yet a grown man. His other sons, Jerry and Rowley, were too young for this sort of thing. Sam did not know about his paternity, but Ralph nursed the secret with pleasure. They were horrified by what they saw as they went around. Hundreds of Ralph's serfs were dead or dying, and the corn was standing unharvested in the fields. As they rode from one place to the next, Ralph's anger and frustration grew. His sarcastic remarks cowed his companions, and his bad temper turned his horse skittish. In each village, as well as the serfs' landholdings, some acres were kept exclusively for the Earl's personal use. They should have been cultivated by his employees and by serfs who were obliged to work for him one day a week. These lands were in the worst state of all. Many of his employees had died. So had some of the serfs who owed him labor. Other serfs had negotiated more favorable tenancies after the last plague, so that they no longer had to work for the Lord. And finally, it was impossible to find laborers for hire. When Ralph came to Wigley, he went around the back of the manor house and looked into the big timber barn, which at this time of year should have been filling with grain ready for milling. But it was empty, and a cat had given birth to a litter of kittens in the hayloft.
"What will we do for bread?" he roared at Nathan Reeve. "With no barley to make ale, what will we drink? You'd better have a plan, by God!"
Nate looked churlish. "All we can do is reallocate the strips," he said. Ralph was surprised by his surliness. Nate was usually sycophantic. Then Nate glared at young Sam, and Ralph realized why the worm had turned. Nate hated Sam for killing Jono, his son. Instead of punishing Sam, Ralph had first pardoned him, then made him a squire. No wonder Nate looked resentful. Ralph said, "There must be one or two young men in the village who could farm some extra acres." "Ah, yes, but they aren't willing to pay an entry fee," Nate said.
"They want land for nothing?"
"Yes. They can see that you have too much land and not enough labour, and they know when they're in a strong bargaining position."
In the past, Nate had been quick to abuse uppity peasants, but now he seemed to be enjoying Ralph's dilemma.
"They act as if England belongs to them, not to the nobility," Ralph said angrily.
"It is disgraceful, Lord," said Nate more politely, and a sly look came over his face. "For example, Wulfric's son Davy wants to marry Amabel and take over her mother's land. It would make sense. Annet has never been able to manage her holding."
Sam spoke up.
"My parents won't pay the entry fee. They're against the marriage."
Nate said, "Davy could pay it himself, though." Ralph was surprised.
"How?"
"He sold that new crop he grew in the forest."
"Madder. Obviously we didn't do a sufficiently thorough job of trampling it. How much did he get?"
"No one knows, but Gwenda has bought a young milking cow, and Wulfric has a new knife, and Amabel wore a yellow scarf to church on Sunday."
And Nate had been offered a fat bribe, Ralph guessed. "I hate to reward Davy's disobedience," he said, "but I'm desperate.
Let him have the land."
"You would have to give him special permission to marry against his parents' will."
Davy had asked Ralph for this, and Ralph had turned him down, but that was before the plague decimated the peasantry. He did not like to revisit such decisions. However, it was a small price to pay.
"I shall give him permission," he said.
"Very well,
but let's go and see him. I'd like to make the offer in person."
Nate was startled, but of course made no objection. The truth was that Ralph wanted to see Gwenda again. There was something about her that made his throat go dry. His last encounter with her in the little hunting lodge had not satisfied him for long. He had thought about her often in the weeks since then. He got little satisfaction nowadays from the kind of women he normally lay with, young prostitutes, tavern wenches, and maid servants. They all pretended to be delighted by his advances, though he knew they just wanted the present of money that came afterwards. Gwenda, by contrast, made no secret of the fact that she loathed him and shuddered at his touch, and that pleased him paradoxically, because it was honest and therefore real. After their meeting in the hunting lodge, he had given her a purse of silver pennies, and she had thrown it back at him so hard that it had bruised his chest.
"They're in Brookfield today, turning their reaped barley," Nate said. "I'll take you there."
Ralph and his men followed Nate out of the village and along the bank of the stream at the edge of the great field. Wigley was always windy, but today the summer breeze was soft and warm, like Gwenda's breasts. Some of the strips of land here had been reaped, but in others Ralph despaired to see overripe oats, barley rank with weeds, and one patch of rye that had been reaped but not bundled, so that the crop lay scattered on the ground. A year ago he had thought that all his financial troubles were over. He had come home from the most recent French war with a captive, the Marquis de Neuchâtel, and had negotiated a ransom of £50,000, but the Marquis's family had not been able to raise the money. Something similar had happened to the French king, Jean II, captured by the Prince of Wales at the Battle of Poitiers. King Jean had stayed in London for 4 years, technically a prisoner, though living in comfort at the Savoy, the new palace built by the Duke of Lancaster. The king's ransom had been reduced, but still it had not been paid in full. Ralph had sent Alan Fernhill to Neuchâtel to renegotiate his prisoner's ransom, and Alan had reduced the price to 20,000, but again the family had failed to pay it. Then the Marquis had died of the plague, so Ralph was insolvent again and had to worry about the harvest. It was midday. The peasants were having their dinner at the side of the field. Gwenda, Wulfric, and Davy were sitting on the ground under a tree, eating cold pork with raw onions. They all jumped to their feet when the horses came near. Ralph went over to Gwenda's family and waved the rest away. Gwenda wore a loose green dress that hid her shape. Her hair was tied back, making her face more rat-like. Her hands were dirty, with earth under the nails. But when Ralph looked at her, in his imagination he saw her naked, ready, waiting for him with an expression of resigned disgust at what he was about to do, and he felt aroused. He looked away from her to her husband. Wulfric stared back at him with a level gaze, neither defiant nor cowed. There was a little grey now in his tawny beard, but still it would not grow over the scar of the sword cut Ralph had given him. "Wulfric! Your son wants to marry Amabel and take over Annet's land." Gwenda responded. She had never learned to speak only when spoken to. "You've stolen one son from me. Will you take the other now?" she said bitterly. Ralph ignored her. "Who will pay the heriot?" Nate put in, "It's 30 shillings. Wulfric said, "I haven't got 30 shillings. Davy said calmly, "I can pay it." He must have done very well out of his madder crop, Ralph thought, to be so cool about such a large sum of money. "Good," he said. "In that case," Davy interrupted him, "but on what terms are you offering it?" Ralph felt his face redden. "What do you mean?" Nate intervened again. "The same terms as those upon which Annet holds the land, of course." Davy said, "Then I thank the Earl, but I will not accept his gracious offer." Ralph said, "What the devil are you talking about?" "I would like to take over the land, my lord, but only as a free tenant, paying cash rent without customary dues." Sir Alan said threateningly, "Do you dare to haggle with the Earl of Shiring, you insolent young dog?" Davy was scared but defiant. "I've no wish to offend, lord, but I want to be free to grow whatever crop I can sell. I don't want to cultivate what Nate Reeve chooses, regardless of market prices." Davy had inherited that streak of stubborn determination from Gwenda, Ralph thought. He said angrily, "Nate expresses my wishes. Do you think you know better than your earl? Forgive me, lord, but you neither till the soil nor go to market." Alan's hand went to the hilt of his sword. Ralph saw Wulfric glance at his scythe, lying on the ground, its sharp blade gleaming in the sunlight. On Ralph's other side, young Sam's horse skittered nervously, picking up its rider's tension. If it came to a fight, Ralph thought, would Sam fight for his lord or for his family? Ralph did not want to fight. He wanted to get the harvest in, and killing his peasants would make that harder. He restrained Alan with a gesture. "This is how the plague undermines morality," he said disgustedly. "I will give you what you want, Davy, because I must." Davy swallowed dryly and said, "In writing, lord." "You're demanding a copyhold, too?" Davy nodded, too frightened to speak. "Do you doubt
the word of your earl?
No, lord.
Then why demand a written lease? For the avoidance of doubt in future years?
They all said that when they asked for a copyhold. What they meant was that if the lease was written down,